Welcome to the Odelay Show. It's December 25th, 2020. The Cold War is or was over. Yet, policy out of Washington, D.C. has continued prosecuting the previous Cold War, so-called, which began at the close of World War II. In effect, Washington, D.C. is also instigating a new Cold War, if you're to believe the corporate media, but war of any sort must be averted and contained. Wars have a permanence to them, which, due to the very nature of war, is a very serious metaphysical problem. The fact is obvious at heart. The buildup of the United States naval fleet in the Asian Pacific, as has been occurring for some years, and as explicitly stipulated and reminded in the upcoming year's National Defense Authorization Act budget, $3.25 trillion, that, for example, along with an unnecessary, non-productive, overt, and frankly suicidal militarization of space, as well as this week's shuttering of consulates in Russia, are all completely avoidable policies which will invariably make life on Earth darker through this current century and beyond. You don't blow things up that you don't have to blow up in orbit, okay? Then you can't get out. But you don't choke out the oceans, then you can't live either. Sorts of things you think you wouldn't need to be reminded of. One of the key reasons such policies being affected by the so-called neoconservatives and the so-called neoliberals, together alike, is their consensus interest to effectively occupy the United States national government, the nature of which I have discussed in recent editions of this program. The occupiers are fully committed to the perpetuation of their various selfish, coerced, and belligerent policies. They don't necessarily have to like each other, but they do agree about their hobbling of the American government and, in general, the peace globally, and the hell they're creating on Earth. Moreover, they've been successful in realizing their goals, as there is no apparent end in sight to their tyranny against the civil liberties of the United States citizenry, who are an incidental but necessary collateral damage, casualty to their eschatology. They don't care. What a great game. Nor does the suffering of foreigners bother them, who are subject to their hot wars and occupations, for whom there seems to be in sight no due process either. Granted, many of the borders in the Mideast were drawn there in crayon, as it were, for political reasons after World War II, and it's that kind of incumbent ponsmanship, which is people feel is within their providence to lord and lord over and lord under in the Middle East with the Arabs and the Jews and the Muslims. But generally, anyway, the people in that region have been there for thousands of years, regardless of the geopolitical whimsy of fools and newcomers, like the American Politburo who occupies the national government now. And you could argue very easily, and people know historically, it's a fact that the United States is a newcomer in the broader context of Western history. Again, one key casualty, even if you're not talking about the people who are so malignant now at the helm, again, one key casualty is the suspension of civil liberties in the United States. And I think that's perhaps more eye-catching to the confused United States citizenry than the fundamental source of the decaying quality of life in the United States, and that is the endless imperial occupations. But I mean, just as it affects here at home, it's everybody else. I keep talking about that throughout the rest of this program. As a matter of fact, civil liberties must be rolled back during wartime. I've talked about that before. Information is how you win wars. Although at some point, the buck must stop, because wars are wars, and not wars are not wars. Therefore, when wars are ideologically rooted and are designed as a long-term economic venture, the repercussions become the uncharted stuff of dystopian science fiction. I admit I'm recycling a lot of my talking points in this episode, but there are a few key points I'm walking out with. I say, among humanity, whenever any measure of peace is achieved, it is to be treasured and not squandered, whether it involves a productive relationship between Jack Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, or the reunification and healing of Germany, or the dissolution of the Soviet Union and founding of the Russian Federation, or the end of apartheid in South Africa, or due process removal of malevolent actors from the levers of power in the United States of America. Make hockey, not war. I'm telling you. In the United States of America, if we cannot undo the increasingly catastrophic relationship between the banks and the Federal Reserve, nor between the partisan legislators and the corporate special interests, nor between the imperial war deep state and the presidency, then we must dissolve the two American political parties, which are blocking much-needed adjustment, growth, and change with the times, and meanwhile, frustrating the much-needed everyday human wisdom and natural leadership in governmental affairs, in world affairs, in daily life, in humanity. Can't have it both ways and go progressive all the way and fix it till it's broke, and then this be the result. Of course, this is why Founding Fathers' argument for just a flat-out zero tolerance for a strong central government, because they knew in the epoch on the European continent, which they were leaving happily, that it always turns out this way. Always. And they're like, you can say it and pretty it up all day. We know what's going to happen. We're going to put up with it. This was an experiment in the new world. And it was the new world, as it were, so to speak. And it could be run like the old world, or it could be done with it in an experimental new way. And if you like it over there, then go back. Yeah. But people have to sleep. And when you sleep at night, people come in and steal your shit, which is what happened United States of America, and it still happened today at a fever pitch. It's bringing about the end, as far as I can tell. Anyway, I will repeat the previous talking point about dissolving those two political parties. I'm very serious. It's the whole MO of this today's program. They're really just one party, equally hedged upon by the uniform monolithic international corporate interest, which occupy the United States national government, to include the international imperial war interest. That's the only way in, I guess, at this point. All right, so that's the plan. Dedicate the rest of my political career to it, as far as it does exist. If we do not cast off the partisan fetters and the corporate rot, then we're very politely asking the current partisans of the partisan-occupied legislative body in the United States to reform themselves, which is a naive and foolish approach, and everyone knows it. The people's good faith voice does not compete with hookers and cocaine. And that's what drives Congress. It's what drives the economy. It's what drives the world, therefore. It really is something that I think literally every person in the world who has eyes to see it can plainly see. This is one of those kind of political baselines for which there is no real dissent. There's obfuscation and subterfuge and nonsense. Quit it! How about that for broad-based electoral support? Unfortunately, simply not voting for anyone from either party, which is what I've been doing, although it is how the majority of U.S. citizens respond. It would be nice if they'd all just respond on a third party. I mean, nicer than what we got now. Most people just flat out don't vote. More than half. But that nevertheless still leaves those parties in control. The Democratic and Republican national politburos, which occupy American government. The increasing appeals to populist ideology in national elections has caused in recent decades a gradual increase in voter turnout, if Wikipedia is to be believed, from an average of mid to high 30th percentile in the 1980s and 90s to the low 40th percentile range in the aughts and in the teens. And in this year, there was a spike to 47% in the national presidential election last month. But that's still less than half, and usually much less so. And congressional elections are comparable in their relative attrition. The system is neither democratic nor representative. Moreover, the naturally conservative underpinnings of the electoral system are manipulated grotesquely by capital interests. And that's further aggravated by the partisan castling. Now, you can say political action groups and the coercion of the media to be a propaganda machine and the the substantive due process garbage from the Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, on a Hillary Clinton case, Citizens United, calls money speech. But the real problem with the money is all of the off-the-book stuff. And that's where you get the extra zeros and the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that infest and infect, like a cancer, the governing institutions established in the United States, our Constitution, for the Union. If politicians had to be concerned about what 100% of the eligible U.S. voters might do with their ballots, or with their other hand, it would positively influence their popular policy, I think. But of course, right now, it's easier for any elected official to tilt the hedge of their responsibility for competent public governance and their oaths to uphold the Constitution against the necessities, relative necessities, therefore, of the political cottage industry, which they must abide. So the political compromise to get over the fence into the legislature is too much. Definitively. Widespread media censorship in the United States, virulent propaganda, criminal restrictions on speech and assembly, automated or hair-triggered lockstep policing of political correctness in the public and professional realms by unelected and unelectable agency, martial law and posse comitatus, and we are under martial law. Make no mistake about it, and it's been increasing for a long time. Didn't even necessarily have to be declared as such. Probably ought to serve process, and a wrecking of the currency and the economy with bank bailouts and other corporate welfare are a few problems which come to mind. I always bring up the TARP bailouts from George W. Bush administration, where those banks and criminal enterprises and insurance companies and conglomerates should have been allowed to fail and been prosecuted for the laws that they broke, that basically toppled the United States economy. And he bailed them out with taxpayer money. I've been unemployed almost all the way since then. I mean, I've gone back to school. I've had several jobs, had a career change and all kinds of stuff. But I've been knocking around. I'm just not dead set on it, you know, like my father on whatever, 50 years of career, same place, whatever he had. People don't do that anymore. I mean, people do. Not many. Anyway, U.S. imperial policy does, and then Mr. Obama, like, tripled down on that business. And who cares? It's just credit. And for people like, I think, I guess, George Bush, it's like, well, it's not really my money. I'm from an old money family. Who gives a shit? And for people like Barack Obama, I suspect they're kind of new money. And that's credit. And so he's like, it's credit. This is what you do with credit. So, I mean, last week's show, I said, are we really blaming Ronald Reagan like we blame a dog for licking his balls? Or you think Ronald Reagan's not going to do what he said? You know, look at the guy. So U.S. imperial policy does provide excellent cover for Russian military operations, a little segue here, in the Mideast. Otherwise, the Russian Federation, where it to persist in influencing and occupying the region without support and political quarter from the USA, would either have to shoulder the propaganda and the logistical effort alone or withdraw. Or maybe it might enlist the assistance of the People's Republic of China's military. Or perhaps the Chinese military would already be there if the United States of America's military weren't. But let me remind you all, the United States of America is on the North American continent, generally, virtually 100% of it. What would it look like to have a 30-year Chinese or Russian bombing and air assault and ground-land campaign and blockade naval and special forces operations down at Yucatan or Oaxaca or Colombia? You know, that's what it's like for the people who live over there. It's like, well, the United States is over here in the yard, in the backyard. So regardless of one's position about the tactics and management style of leadership of the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin, what have you, it is nevertheless accurate that post-Cold War Russia is not the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics anymore. It isn't. The United Russian Federation are a geographically sprawling, continent-sized federal system with a working press and capitalist-driven enterprises and a form of democratic, constitutional, domestic governance wherein common people argue about the constitutionality of gay marriage, if they're so disposed. Sound familiar? Measuring those various institutions, each in comparison with the United States of America or any other so-called First World or Western nation, is beyond the scope of this particular dialogue tonight. Nevertheless, such a closer inspection between the two body politics is a worthy consideration some 30 years since the dissolution of the Soviet Politburo, but it's been being done for a long time. As the two nations have evolved side by side together, tightly allied, practically speaking, yes, in effect. So yes, for example, they have a nuclear arsenal, but their military budget and operations are but a fraction of the USA's military budget. The Russian military bases do not cover the globe as do the United States of America, and they don't evangelize like we do at the level that we do, the breadth, the geographical scope as such. They don't have to. We do it for them. Their culture is not that different than ours at all. There are certain policy issues that are different on, but by and large, come kingdom come, they're more or less interchangeable. You start getting a fine grained analysis. Yes, there are differences, but of course there are. But there's just unequivocally siblings. Meanwhile, the United States of America, in some measure, has aggressively helped support mainland China's Cultural Revolution, Mao's revolution, and it's his known reality of the 20th century, collaborating explicitly since the Nixon administration and collaborating militarily since before World War II. The Intel collusion against the Japanese, thereabouts, involving mainland China is a well-known piece of the World War II ontology and recipe, for better or for worse. So all the belly aching now is as two-faced as prom night and just as dangerous. Oh, China this. Well, guy, you want to talk about, this is textbook, crying wolf. There is a reason why, culturally, after decades of white-knuckled socialism, i.e. communism, that empires like the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union and their constituent proletariats walk out into the world and into the galaxy in the ways that we today see those nations now doing. For all that historical suffrage and faithful investment in those nation states, willing or otherwise, over the past century and more, all the while with these governments having kept their eyes on the prizes of their respective legacy societies. So that's Chairman Mao's Cultural Revolution, that's the Bolshevik Revolution. And they're all hitting pay dirt just about now. Nothing will stop, like America hit pay dirt after World War II, we're still riding it the best we can. Nothing will stop those nations from seeing to it now that their historical yokes of communism yield pay dirt. It's the whole point. That's the generational sacrifice. That's how this works. That's just how that works. It's just, that's the nature. People, it's not new either. It's gone by different names over the years. The same can be said for the industrialized United States of America and all of its socialist tendencies, which, for example, date back politically to the days of, if you want, Abraham Lincoln, Chief Justice John Marshall, central banker Alexander Hamilton, various other Union Republicans, in the service of the British Crown or whoever else was willing to fund their treason. Later on, like I said, the Bolsheviks had much in common with their contemporaries in American government, progressively speaking, in terms of progressive society building. And take a look at the substantive due process policy of the United States Supreme Court, which is still the MO of that court, which is to be found nowhere in the founding documentation. The point is, the society doesn't hunker down in the Articles of Confederation, nor in the Constitution, nor in the Bill of Rights. The point is, the society doesn't hunker down building a socially industrialized continental empire for 100 years or more without tendering its cultural payoff. No civilization, no society, no generations willing to yield that much in back pay. Forget it. Ain't going to happen. This is the deal with the devil, so to speak, of industrialized culture. Generations may suffer, but the ship does sail. And it is why, usually, neo-Marxist propaganda, in whatever form, whenever it comes, wherever it, as it solicits a workforce, can always be traced back to some idealistic socialist progressive propagandist in the employ of the state, who's trying to make the state work for them. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. The biggest difference in government, the biggest difference between the socialist United States of America and the socialist United Soviet Socialist Republic and the socialist People's Republic of China is what they do with the spoils after the fact. Well, China's having another boom. It came later. It didn't really start its cultural revolution until the 60s, that boot. Russia's taking it easy right now. It started at 1917 with eyes on the future. But the United States of American treasury and industry have kind of been plundered in the body politic as having the foreign policy equivalent of a speed addict having a mental breakdown in public, doing the fish. You know, as a political inheritor of what's left of the USA, potentially, I say an intervention is necessary. Again, no civilization is willing to yield that much in lost wages, nor is any generation, which is why the boomers, who are aglow with guilt, the boomer politicians, oh, they reek of it. It's weird. Are trying to transmit their real politic venereal disease to the millennials, and they're succeeding, because those are that's a game of numbers. As far as I can tell, the two towers. It's why we are still dealing with apocalyptic Zionists and spoiled Frenchmen and drunken racists in the American zoo as if they were to be taken seriously. And they're in office often. And that's because of intergenerational cultural transmission. And because religion breeds war and stupidity. Bad religion, anyway. It's why rank and labels matter, and also why who and what your parents were and did for a living matters, and all so much in a socialist society, which of course, therefore, that all matters so much in the contemporary United States of America, which again, is one of the main reasons for the American Revolutionary War. It was because people didn't want a centralized European style of government, or a traditional aristocracy, and all of it. Garbage that comes with those things. It was new and it was different. And in some ways, somewhere, I think it can still be found. You have to hide and look for it to find it, and you have to hide to preserve it. The difference between the United States of America type of communism and its 20th century progressive substantive due process communism and the 20th century its 20th century communist contemporaries progressive contemporaries are that the spoils of it are being stolen from the legacy United inheritors in the USA. That's what happens when widespread political and historical ignorance prevails in your progressive utopia. This is why you do, and this is why, to keep people from coming out of step, this is why at the lead of these governments ride herd on the masses so uniformly. That's why there can be no dissent. Now, so what you've got are the boomers doubling down, colluding with the millennials now, and I think Gen X is just really taking it on the chin. Not interested. I do not want a pair of that shit. And I'm not interested. Broke anyway. Philosopher. This is why you do the very best to educate the young Americans in your classroom, regardless of what color they are, how much money they have, or what type they live, what part of town, where their parents are from. That is, you do so because you cannot afford not to. Politically. And more generally, it's the right thing to do. And that's called altruism, and those who don't have it do not survive as a nation or as a species, and nor as a hockey team. And that's egalitarian. If you don't do it, then all there is are just the old blood laws. Murder, death, and war. That's it. Forget it. That's why we teach. Never seen a field more politicized than education. And it's because it's under assault. People are it's a soft target for political fighting. All people are not created the same. I got to say that, man. People are horrible monsters. They don't care if they piss away all of humanity, certainly not injured the children, all just to execute their little plan. And this is people from all backgrounds. I'm not making a genetic argument here. I'm just saying most humans are stupid as mud and mean and base, and it's awful. This is the excuse, I think, that people have for, they're just like, bring the hammer down. Who cares? Mean and horrible anyway. There's a quote on my page right below this posting that's like Thomas Jefferson talking about, two kinds of people in a constitutional form of governance. Some who try to get all the power up to the high end themselves, they don't trust anybody, and the others who realize that distributing the power, is the best way to teach and to learn. But there's a little clause. There's a letter to somebody. I got the quote on who's writing it for you. There's a little clause. It's like, even though maybe they're not always the most good at it. But, the alternative is a fascist regime. Today, the United States of America, just today, go look what's going on in the world today out in your neighborhood, your town. It is a fascist, generationally revolving socialist central bank funded war machine, sort of like a confused hooker or a malfunctioning pinball machine kind of bred together, which carries a relatively few rich on the backs of the working class. Granted, that's colored a little bit by the fact that we're under martial law. Okay? You're going to find that it's a little fascistic out there when you're under police law. And habeas corpus is suspended and the like. I've just come up with an idea for an editorial cartoon with that pinball confused hooker thing. Anyway, a working class, which is... We'll look for that next week, maybe. Working class, which is, by the way, disappearing. The working class that rides on the backs of the relatively few rich. Excuse me. The working class upon whose back ride the relatively few rich. And working class, which, by the way, is disappearing. That's why there is all of the bravado and machismo from the central government now, because those rich and their footmen know their mount is dead beneath them. And they're spreading their ideology to whoever's next, and brute force and fabrications all they have left, and lies. Therefore, they have nothing to lose, of course, hence their apocalyptic stranglehold on stupid policy at a time when it's completely unnecessary and frankly unprovoked. You got three major powers coming out of dark nights of the soul right now. There is no reason for us to shit the bed on this now. People have been ready, preparing for the millennium, for... new millennium for long decades, centuries. No reason to do the fish now. But it's like, just like on cue, people begin doing the fish. Russia is in many ways post-imperial. Its sphere of influence is economically auditable, and militarily it is fairly well restricted to the continent, or rather two continents, but that's a lot of hockey ice anyway. Russia seems content with its situation, but for the awkward extra-continental interloping of the United States of America on multiple fronts, Russia was one of the greatest allies of the United States of America strategically throughout the entire 20th century up to today, both in terms of as being an enabler of or collaborator with fiat U.S. foreign policy as it saw fit militarily, and in terms of key alignments during both world wars. The toil of a little dust up here and there, but it's what made those war economies go. Now it's all the United States has left. The toils and historical suffrage of the people of the United States, of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, Soviet Union, for better or worse, is now being more or less directed pastorally into the sunset forever, for a happy ending, notwithstanding tantrums from the big, dangerous paisano loco of the West, the USA. They were smart. There was like one building that, you know, I mean, there was a little bloodshed when the Soviet Politburo was dissolved, but there was nothing crazy. Like, you know, there was no major shutter. And they preserved it. And they're able to stand up. It's a walk-off home run. That's not the way we're going over here with these fools. These monsters that are criminals, and they got to come out one way or the other. And I'm being nice and saying dissolve those parties that shoo them in there and lock them in there. But they're coming out one way or the other. China's main thrust is economical, strictly business, which was originally supposed to be the main driver of the civil U.S. foreign policy. Okay? Most of the manufactured materials I see are Chinese. That was, you know, and that's attributable to nothing but U.S. progressive U.S. policy, economic policy. So, therefore, now seeing Washington, D.C. throw tantrums militarily threatening, dangerous tantrums at China, is as two-faced as a senior prom and just as dangerous, as I said. It's like playing cards with the kids who throw a fit because they lose, tump over the table. I mean, we've already lost Formosa and Hong Kong just this year because they didn't have to keep letting it do. We were there. The British were there. Hong Kong, the free city, and Taiwan as a republic. We're, regardless of what the paperwork said in mainland China, we're operating as open and free at the pleasure of mainland China. And they were pleased to do it. The current outbound president seems to have thought that the economic policy was a problem. that it was unbalanced between the United States and China. And it was. And whose fault was that? Well, who outsourced all the industry? That happened on Bill Clinton's watch. You know? Basically. You're not supposed to give it all. But anyway, so the East will not simply capitulate to an unethical bully or a spoiled child. They've got all they need, and they have arrived at the world party of the 21st century, ready to have a nice time. But if a belligerent United States of America and its foreign policy is intent on making itself a fool at the party, and it will be obliged. Would you like your experience over the past year of 2020 coronavirus garbage to be elongated for 100 years? Somebody turn that up to 11, you're not going to have a choice. You do? We'll keep biting at the ankles of the Chinese. You want to wake up 1,000 years from now, find yourself sewn into a Siberian teepee, wedding hat, pillow? You do? Well, then keep taking shots over the bow of the Russian Enterprise. Because they're just sitting there. Okay? Trying to be polite. Now, the outbound president, Mr. Trump's opinion about China. Like, he's a businessman, and it's obvious even to someone who's not an economist that it was all kind of going one way. And increasingly so. Like the suck of all that economy leaving the North American continent. But I don't know, maybe he just, I don't know, does he have investments over there? I mean, he does pretty much everywhere else. I don't know. It is a perverse hypocrisy for the United States of America to cry foul at the behavior of China or Russia when the United States of America is the author and model and often the instigator of many such behaviors that it complains about, in fact, and which China and Russia have to some extent mitigated and improved upon, because both nations actually represent newer experiments in government and both also superimposed on much longer established geocultural hegemony. All right? Russia is at a time, that's a special case. Over here, we're always going to be, to some extent, two-dimensional. Because when you get right down to the very nut of constitutional or natural law, you're sitting on an ancient mineral burial ground. And I can tell you, as a shaman, friend of a shaman, I can tell you, they're not going to let... No. The native indigenous peoples in North America, they're not gone and they're not leaving. But they are big in a natural law. That's where some separate peace has been found. And it's along those lines, politically, that you make a friend with some of the people who are here, who live here, whose traditional home is where I am in Southeast Arizona. This is Apache country. Russia's at a time of gathering and not spending right now. China's the opposite. They're booming. The United States of America should be at a time of gathering, not spending, but it is not. It is the other way, troublingly. Consequently, the rude awakening being experienced by the people of the United States of America will get much worse because the United States of America lacks responsible leadership that, regardless of Cold Wars and industrial revolutions and technological revolutions past or present, the leadership is not prudently closing the deal for those many generations of citizens who have paid into the system with their lives, blood, and families. George W. Bush just comes right and says, they're just going to flush Social Security. There's just nothing. While I bail out my friends, and in the wake of Bill Clinton selling all of the industry out of America, I'm going to take away what little keeps people from having to eat cat food when they get old. They just don't give it. They don't care, these people. They don't care. They hate you. They hate you just because they can. I hate it that George W. Bush bogs around and pretends to be from and lives in Texas. The United States of America has been being pilfered for many decades, and nothing remains but for a few ham-fisted, disastrous, and obviously overhedged plans of action. It is time for the United States of America to gather, not spend, ebb as well as it flows, and to make peace with powers across the seas as have predecessor empires of Europe, and to be more frugal with its legacy, its existence, and its peace. fragile as it is. I mean, it doesn't exist. For the United States of America to squander the relatively restrained and negotiable Chinese and Russian countenances of the new 21st century, relatively new 21st century, is pure folly. Well, one-fifth over. And also, of course, the ongoing assault upon the beautiful, rich, ancient, and fascinating human cultures of the Middle East, where we all came from. Likewise, folly. It is making the enemy of all pieces, where we all got our alphabets and our algebra and, hey, and our geometry. That's the cornerstone of Western civilization. We're over there blowing up libraries for 30 years, 20, whatever. It's infuriating. As a publisher and a writer and a bibliophile, that's pretty much unforgivable. It's one thing to do ethnic cleansing, and that's a thing, and so is book burning. But it's really, I said this last show, people who burn books eventually burn people. It is making an enemy of all peace-loving good people. Moreover, the prosecution and perpetuation of holy wars, which the United States of America is doing in the Middle East, is perhaps the height of philosophical folly. I mean, how brickish. I mean, talk about Philistines, right? For those of you who cannot see Penn, they'll tell you, yeah, you got to watch out. People will remember if you do something. If you slip up, they won't forget for thousands of years. You got to remember to be judicious and fair and forgiving and thoughtful and forward-looking and even-minded. And non-reactionary. For those of you who cannot see past your own world, remember that the key is taking baby steps. Often as an astronaut aboard my own ship of the mind, and sometimes Neil deGrasse Tyson flies by near to visit, and Carl Sagan, you know him too. But I forget that some in my head that people lack prescience or vision. It's like, okay, that's why in the here and now I trip over my own cats and guitars and terrify the robots if I drift off script, which is all the time at the grocery store. Like, people don't know what to do with me. So, baby steps. On the way forward to the 20th, I'm in a red, basically, area. About to move it back into a blue zone. And maybe make some friends. You know? Not like lonely, but it's like, geez, I don't know who to talk to. So I do the show. Anyway, I have the time off, so it's fine. It, by the way, takes, writing this, you know, and then translating it, perfecting it, and then translating it, and then printing it. Several days of work each week. The way forward to the 22nd century, baby steps here, is to placate and nurture our common womb, which is the earth, a vessel who will serve us well for thousands of years if treated kindly and respectfully while we continue our way. How long do you think the other side will put up with it before it scrubs one of the big keels? And why shouldn't they? I mean, that's an option. Probably not off the table. Probably won't happen. But it would definitely be one way to communicate how fed up. And how long? We've got 30 years. We'll go 60 before we'll think about that. Shit. How would the Pentagon respond? Maybe by nuking cities full of civilians, which would effectively kill everyone and everything ultimately. And why? What really started the fight? Spoiled American Ivy League graduates in the thrall of international money and whoever's left over from the French bourgeois of this, you know, 18th century. Get off. That's what. With it, I'm quoting Kurt Vonnegut. What is it? The real nightmare is waking up one day and realizing the people we went to high school with are in charge. That's what's up. That's the problem. That's the mindsets you got going on. Anyway, so, I mean, at least there's ways to overcome it. But Jesus, I want some results now. I've had it. It's a recipe for completely needless apocalypse. The spoiled American Ivy League graduates who have stolen it and are committing atrocities that won't be forgiven for thousands of years and will be blaming the likes of me. Barring navigation rights, of what business is the Asia Pacific to the United States Navy? Okay? And there's trade. The Navy's not really involved in trade. It is true that sloppy offshore drilling is filthy and will choke out the oceans and the skies, but that seems to be a foregone conclusion anyway, and nuclear conflagration works much faster. I refer you to an article by the Pulitzer Prize-winning seminarian Chris Hedges that was published this week on the solstice, incidentally, titled The Great Delusion. He's right about the end being unavoidable at this point, but only the most base and faithless of creatures continues to offend despite obvious looming reckoning. Zazen. I promise an important policy question on the minds of virtually every responsible government entity in the planet is, how can we contain the Americans? I'm sure that some plans are more flexible and restrained than others, but there's no question that it is the most common problem geopolitically. And the second most typical discussion involves what to do about the myriad problems, respectively, which stem from stupid American policy. There are other habits of the hostile imperial power which occupies the United States, America's national government, that make transgressions much easier for foreign entities, of course. The above-mentioned example in the Middle East is just so glaring, and there's so many examples of it in the Middle East. But an open-air slave trade in North Africa, which was tipped off, which is a result of policy from the first black president, ironically, and his arbitrary and capricious and unwise and stupid, him and Hillary Clinton's Libyan escapade, which has caused that place to be headless, and it's just headless North Africa. Weapons going all different directions, and now there's open air slave markets there again. I don't know how long it's been since those were actually all shuttered. But they're there again, according to the reportage. So, South America. You got some harder lined, Oceania, and some harder lined in Norte Americana down there. The former mayor of Jalisco was shot in a restaurant and killed last week. I don't know why. It might have been sort of a dating situation. Who knows? It's late at night. It's like 1:30 in the morning. It leads me to speculate. So, transgressions, which other habits of hostile imperial power, which occupies the United States national government, which makes transgressions much easier for foreign entities. Hit another Middle East topic. The Palestinian problem. We're not in a holy war, but let's move let's move the embassy to Jerusalem. Sweet baby Jesus. I'll tell you what, Jesus hates you. He doesn't need to judge, right? Shit. A raccoon trap could judge that. Whatever. Any other automata. Don't have to be very deep to see that that's conflicted. When you see and the context that it exists, that it takes place in, when you see fascists or their toadies like David Sanger, Hillary Clinton, James Clapper, Michael Morrell, Tom Bossert, Judith Miller, Adam Schiff, Mike Pompeo, Anthony Blinken, Janet Yellen, Avril Haines, Neera Tanden, Jake Sullivan, Liz Cheney et al., working to encourage, cheerlead, or otherwise lubricate, prolong new century-long cold wars with China and Russia, for example, which will just further give quarter to proxy wars like what you have in the Middle East and elsewhere, then it does highlight who are the original belligerents, the problem starters, the instigators and perpetuators, the foolish and selfish squanderers of the precious peace so soon after the conclusion of the 20th century's Cold War. That was 30 years ago. It doesn't seem like it's been that long. Keeping up with this act, I finished high school and then had some troubles and went back to college and got out, had a career for a decade and change, and went back to school, and here I am in 30 years. Bam! 45 years old. It's crazy. I'm just bragging. Keeping up with this act, the United States of America will doubly be penetrated, and it's already begun. The black flags are already going up. I see them. It is ominous. People may love me, but I may have to go down with the rest of these a-holes just because there's so many over here. This is why people are leaving the country. It's reflected within our current domestic mayhem. At this point, the United States of America is quite helpless culturally. I'm just blind and uneducated. The schools have been declawed long ago. I mean, unless you were happened to be within the Providence, and that wasn't, you may have been at a public school, but if you got an education, it was because of an extraordinary focus on you, not because you remember the public. And if you didn't, and that's most people, well, there was more of that to come. You should see it now. And we're economically hobbled. I would argue that it's worse than, you know what I mean? I'm just me saying. Be wary of the death blow, which could be easily delivered by a number of parties in a number of different ways. And this real estate bubble, like, I mean, who's going to pop it? Why bother popping it? I mean, you know, that's just not how the economy works anymore. The problem is, if I'm going to move, I'd like not to pay six figures for some dump. God. You know, then I'm going to have to fund with debt. Such policies must be walked away from, but the partisan lock on the hostile occupation of U.S. national government has been unmolested by current electoral efforts, modern, rather than petty interlegislative, since that, whatever, that agreement with the security state and Eisenhower and Truman, Truman, Eisenhower, Jack Kennedy, right thereabouts. You know, so I think it was Truman that kind of let it roll. To begin with, and then it kind of got out of hand under Eisenhower, and then by the time Jack Kennedy got there, it was bad enough that if the president gets in the way of it, he loses his head. Rather than petty interlegislative warfare, which contributes to the failure of policy, then here again is my consideration. If we cannot undo the increasingly catastrophic relationship between the banks and the Federal Reserve, that central banking that's funding these wars, nor between the partisan legislators and the corporate special interests, nor between the imperial deep war state and the presidency, then we dissolve the so-called, so to speak, two, quote-unquote, two political parties in the United States. They're really one party. It's a one-party system. And again, as we cannot undo the increasingly catastrophic, it was a dictatorship, in a sense, by committee. It's a parliamentary dictatorship. And again, as we cannot, you know, which is not what it was supposed to have been. People will tell you it is. They're so glad of it because they're dumb as a brick. Again, they just don't know their history. Maybe they're not that dumb. And who could blame them? I mean, they hadn't been led to water. As we cannot undo the increasingly catastrophic relationship between the banks and the Federal Reserve, nor between the partisan legislators and the corporate special interests, nor between the imperial deep war state and the presidency, and it has been demonstrated since 1945 that we cannot, then we must dissolve the two American political parties. It's that easy. Hell on them. Tired of seeing riot police. I'm tired of everyone wearing mail under their shirts, using it on whoever. Tired of the turning away. I'm tired of what's being taught to the children. I'm tired of seeing the truth stomped on. I'm tired of people being punished for doing the right thing. I'm tired of living in a society bought and sold by whores, traitors, and spies who control every stitch of the economy and daily life that can be marketed with political money, and that's everything. Whores, traitors, and spies. This is why. Many Americans have not turned coat to the belligerent occupiers, theoretically, because of that. More than half who don't even vote. But there is still much silence. It further suggests me, to me, further disgusts me, rather, to see so many people falling for the divisive tactics and other lies and manipulations among the national dialogue, which successfully distract from the real issues that need to be addressed. And again, Chris Hedges, the editorialist, or the writer I mentioned previously, he's right about the end. Everybody who's always said the end's coming's been right. Now is an easy time to call it and be right. But I'm not so faithless as to give up, nevertheless, and neither should any free-thinking person be. I'm tired of the footstools of the world governing my community, my economy, my neighborhood, my town, my career, my family, and I'm the cultural and social implications of that. Tired of that. Doesn't need to be this way. Things do not need to continue to be this way. I'm tired of martial law and terrorism at home. Ironically, the result of an ideological war fought in the Mideast and upon, really, against all free people of the world. Ironically, that was inspired by the domestic terrorist attack whose perpetrators explicitly cited United States Americans' intervention and military presence in the Mideast as their justification. 20 years of additional blood on the hands of the United States and its citizens, and in my name, does not resolve this. And of course, it makes things worse. It was the United States intelligence consensus decades ago that the September 11th terrorist attacks were blowback from the United States military presence and policy in the Middle East military. Interventionist. That fact has not changed. That basic civil liberties are a natural aspect of human nature also has not changed in the past 20 years of murder. George W. Bush's war administration got it wrong, and so did his war Congress. And the sooner that policy is retracted,
not so fast there, Congress.
They're like the headless horseman. The better. 20 years is late and horrible, but it's better than 25. An article by Brett Wilkins this week at antiwar.com remarks that human rights violations committed by United States backed forces are a, quote, recruitment boon for militants, close quote. The article discusses recent mass murders of Afghan boys who could be physically capable of becoming soldiers, even though they're basically children, statutorily, or they're intellectually capable of understanding the history of what the United States war in Afghanistan has done to their people. In other words, it brings to light this reportage in the Wilkins piece, at any war, the sort of generational ethnic cleansing which is ostensibly necessary for successful litigation of an ideological war prosecuted by an imperial force on foreign soil. The last paragraph of Wilkins' article, excuse me, is a quote from a Taliban spokesperson named Zabihullah Mujahideen, taken from an article in the former Greenwald publication called The Intercept, which he apparently helped found and which he was thrown out of because an article he wrote didn't reflect favorably upon the editorial board's preferred presidential candidate. Off topic. The man said, the quote, Mr. Mujahideen, the more they terrorize, the more our numbers increase. Such attacks will have no adverse effect on morale of our Mujahideen. On the contrary, they have a positive effect. I mentioned this last week's show, Robert Pape's work, University of Chicago professor and foreign policy analyst. You can look him up, he's on Wikipedia. And it's well understood. Sociology of what happens when war happens, especially unjust ones. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, you get thousands and thousands of years of unforgiven grudge. And justly. That effect is obvious as the day is long, that recruiting effect this has on their Mujahideen. I suspect the same defense would be mustered or attempted to be mustered in North America well into the next Stone Age if an ideological foreign military was brutally occupying the United States of America. Has in the past. People just take different tacks. Will it again? So take a look outside. The very dwindling, fleeting peace, if you still have it, is fleeting. The few people under the circumstances. And will vacate you entirely if you do not put your hands on the throttle. The few people who are getting rich from these apocalyptic wars and their political bureaucrats, they're not Americans, really. Their shills often are. Their shills are American statesmen. Officially. They're congressmen and presidents. All the people getting rich off these wars and their political bureaucrats will be all then dead, too, and they certainly don't care about you and the children of the future, if there are any, which is doubtful, will be left with nothing. Boy and His Dog, an old film about with Don Johnson. So you find it in the science fiction genre. It's like the early 80s. It's pre-Miami Vice, right? So, I mean, it was the 70s, maybe even. The Boy and His Dog. Would have been, I guess. And it's about this post-apocalyptic world. A boy and his dog. You got to see it if you're into that genre. And just thought. The Mujahideen turned back the Soviet occupation in 1989 after bleeding its military for a decade. Now their children and grandchildren, I mean, you can't really win out there. It's just a thing to do. Their children and grandchildren now continue to fight the imperialist foreigners in their homeland, which would seem to be the main reasons United States-backed military forces are trying to kill them all down to the last child. I mean, that's what they're doing. It's an ideological war. Remember, eventually the good, the innocent, and the righteous do prevail. Those ancient cultures are counting on it. Again, if we cannot undo the increasingly catastrophic relationship between the banks and the Federal Reserve, nor between the partisan legislators and the corporate special interests, nor between the imperial war deep state and the presidency, then we dissolve these two American political caucuses. America's police state is bad, but it is a symptom of empire and war. The root of the disease of war, which is what above all must be defunded. Okay? The United States Congress has the power of the purse, and one of the shackles that makes it currently inaccessible to adjustment on this fundamental issue of governance is the cottage industry of partisan politics. It is a window dressing. It is a classist lie that we have a two-party system. And we remove that lie, and we can get better at the mechanisms of control. So away with it. And perhaps with so many unemployed, that's one of the lesser reasons why I won't vote for anybody of either of those two shill parties, because it would make me more legally responsible for what they're doing. That the numbers are gently creeping up to almost half of people who are voting for them is reflecting poorly on, I'm afraid, the intellectual caliber. Anyway, perhaps with so many unemployed, we will see better voter turnout and more qualified candidates. Such deplatforming of the Democratic and Republican parties is the key task for such a uniform voice, okay? That's the deal. That's what we're doing, okay? Let me know how you do. Get back to me. I'll be here in my office. The alternative to regime change in the United States is military defeat, which has already happened. Okay? Our face has just been slightly rubbed in the dog shit so far. But it can get a lot worse. You're caught, and you're not getting away. You better respond, because legally, you're responsible as a citizen. Realizing the reality of that defeat, and that we are living on very borrowed, measured time, remains a necessary step for many Americans. Merry Christmas.